listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flueckiger, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, hello, and welcome to this week's show, LA Talk Radio, where we're talking about how to create your ultimate life, a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy by serving and doing good with the gifts, skills, and talents that you have. I'm excited today because I have a special guest, Philip Hecht. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kellen. Great to be
excited to have you here. Yeah, so thanks for being with me today. So one of the things I like to do, I don't do introductions per se. Mm-hmm. It'll all just sort of come out as we talk. I'd like you to refrain from being modest as I ask you this next question. And, you know, everybody, whether you're 20 or 50 or 70, like me, you live a life and you learn to do things. And you particularly have different ways that you add good. And I use the phrase add good to the world, which means make a difference in a positive way. So what is Philip's like drive, your desire? How do you add good to the world?
Well, that's a great question. Thanks for asking. I do it in two ways. I think there's the personal side and then there's the corporate side, the professional side, right? On the professional side, I help very senior people in what we like to call the C-suite, the executive deck, work and strategize with their organization to become the best organizations that they can become, get out of their own way, remove self-inflicted wounds. On the personal side, it's different. I used to be the chair of a 501(c) charity called Interns for Peace. And we were a tolerance training institute where we actually conducted on-the-ground tolerance training in regions of ethnic strife around the world, Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, you know. And at a very local level here in New York City, I endowed a chair for inner-city kids to attend ballet school and art school, which would normally not be open to them. So that's just my way of giving back over the years.
You know, I knew you. I mean, I know you from another venue, but yeah. There's some things there I did not know. So let's dive into that. We'll dive into both the professional and the personal. You know, we hear the phrase, get out of your own way. So let's go into the corporate C-suite for a minute. What are the ways that you see, and the list is probably long, but pick some that are obvious and maybe near and dear to your heart. What are the ways that senior leaders get in their own way in terms of either being their best selves or helping their companies and so forth excel when, of course, they'll say, well, of course I want to, but they get in their own way. So how does that happen?
Well, we like to call it the rigidity trap, frankly. And it's a fancy way of saying that organizations become victims to their own success. They do something over and over again, and it may have been successful. It may have delivered results. It may have created great people in the line of leadership. But then they get stuck. They fail to adapt. They fail to be nimble. They fail to respond to the marketplace. They fail to be or remain relevant in the markets they choose to compete in because they rigidly continue to do the same thing, thinking it will deliver success. So we work with those executives to unlock that potential, to respond to the market, to get out of their own way. And I do mean their self-inflicted wounds. Sometimes it's assigning downstream a task and the organization just isn't either nimble enough or they haven't bought into the culture enough, frankly, of the objectives of the organization to really deliver. We see a problem right now that, frankly, I think is unique in the last 100 years. And that is that there are literally 5 generations of people working in the marketplace today. That's from Generation Z all the way to retiring baby boomers. And that's a huge difference in what needs to be managed in an organization. And it's very tough because the younger they are, perhaps the less invested they are in the organization or the organization's objectives. So there's a challenge now to keep people in line with the culture and the objectives of the organization.
So there's a couple of things there. One is, you said the rigidity trap, I like that name, which means I did this before and it worked and therefore it must still continue to work.
Exactly.
Why do you suppose, and then there's a whole different thing, which is multi-generational things and less invested, and we'll maybe come back to that in a minute. But why do you suppose, I mean, nobody thinks, if you stop and think about it, that things stay the same. So what is it that causes senior leadership to get so invested on doing things again and again the same way, as opposed to exploring the flexibility and, you know, managing the influx of technology or whatever the things are that they ought to be doing, whether it's cultural or technological? Why is this such a problem?
I think it's a very widespread problem, in fact, not only big, but widespread. And that's because the most senior leadership, it's evolving, right? In the tech sector, you see guys who run around in t-shirts, sneakers, and jeans on, you know, Park Avenue here, you still have buttoned up shirts and ties. So there's a cultural divide in recognizing whether or not the people that you have put in leadership roles are either there too long, or they're inflexible, or they haven't enabled their downstream organization, you know, to make the changes that are really necessary. Now, some do this stellarly well, I might add. It's not that every organization is like this, but there are many in many different verticals. We work in the media sector, the healthcare system sector, the legal profession, and others, Fortune 1000. And there are some that are just magnificent, even in banking, very traditional staid market. I'll give a shout out, JPMC, JP Morgan Chase, a very progressive organization, very traditional leader, extremely well respected, but they have an entire tech sector which is designed to do nothing but work with the organization, invest in and develop or invent the next round of technology that's going to enable them in their market.
You know, I was wondering, there's so much, and you can tell me this is wrong, but something that occurred to me is we talked about the insistence on doing things the old way. And I'm glad that there are some that are doing really well, but let's talk about those that aren't, since that's your fixing that is your specialty. There's a lot of pressure always on profit, mm-hmm. short-term, you know, quarterly earnings and all that kind of stuff, board reports and whatever. Is there some degree of fear involved that if we try some new thing or if we make any kind of evolution, like don't rock the boat, because then maybe we're, you know, we have the short-term profit focus. Is that an issue or is that not really part of the equation?
No, I think it's a major part of the equation, and it's spot on that you caught that. If you ask me professionally, you know, and I've been in consulting and technology for over 40 years, right?
I didn't think you were that old, man. How could you be that 40 years? Oh, man. All right, go ahead.
What I've seen, unfortunately, evolve over time is that organizations, I like to use the expression, it's really difficult for an organization to make a right turn in a swimming pool. And that's really what is being asked of an organization when they literally have to report their progress on a quarter by quarter basis. You can't move that kind of battleship that quickly, nor should you strategize or look downstream on a quarter by quarter basis. But unfortunately, the street puts that pressure on them. So you're right, it becomes a dynamic that is at play in the market, but it can be dealt with, right? Because if you talk about the long game, if you talk about the investments, but at the same time maintain the performance, and that's a bit of a balance, one has to admit, but you can do that at the same time, and that more than likely will satisfy the undue pressure from literally quarterly results. You know, look, my stock, some of my stocks have been punished by this very issue. I'll tell you. So, you know, you can see.
Yeah, I get it. Well, that showed up for me. Another one, I wonder also, and I'd like you to comment on this. I would think of it as, you call it the rigidity trap. Is there ego? What role does ego play? So there's a leader, they've done some cool stuff, and then ideas or thoughts come up, technology or culturally or whatever, and they didn't think of it. So, like, there's a pressure in their own psyche because it's not their plan. And is there an ego role in part of this?
I'm going to have to admit the answer is yes, right?
I'm just asking because you got all this experience.
Part of it's what's often referred to as the pride of authorship. If I didn't invent it, it can't possibly be good enough for the organization. The other part, frankly, is there are, you know, the most senior leadership really, honestly, can't work on more than a top 5 or 10 list to move the organization forward or in the direction it needs to. So they have to have faith in people downstream in their organization and some of their leaders. But at the same time, people in the C-suite can be very progressive and want the organization to move and change. But then there's also people in the organization who have long, honestly, outlived their usefulness, or they've been in the same role for 40 years. And even though the most senior leader wants them to make a change, they'll come up with every resistance, story, logic, et cetera, to hold the status quo. And that's exactly what the trap is. Hold the status quo because I invented it here and this is the only way we can do it.
So I love that. So there's a couple of things. What I want you to do now is, whether it's those causes or other causes, slow to recognize market trends, you know, money, ego, performance, whatever, I don't care. When you go into an organization and you see they've called you for whatever reason, somebody sees the writing on the wall, or they had a quarter or two where they got spanked by the board because of XYZ, and they call you in to do that. How do you start to help them get organized to see the kinds of things that they're doing and what they might need to do?
So sometimes there's insight and they know what the problem is or where the problem resides, right? So you can hone in on that. Other times it's like you said, there's a very low satisfaction factor in either the clientele or the employee base. In the healthcare sector, that's often measured. If you ever go online and look at a hospital, they usually have 5 stars there. Well, what's the rating? Well, if you have a clinical rating of 2 stars, that's not great. But if you have a clinical rating of 5 stars, 4.5 stars, you're doing really well. But what about the patient experience? Sometimes that's a 1.8. So, you know, really, you have to, you have to look at what is driving the challenge to the organization. And when it's really not defined, you have to come in and frankly do some deep analytics. And that requires you asking some very tough questions. And I've worked in medical education as well, medical schools, nursing schools, dental schools, and the like. And the deans are often very keenly aware on who is nimble enough to make change and who wants to dig their heels in, right? And that's about the emotional intelligence of their organization and their leadership. And asking tough questions will put some people in a defensive posture, but with respect and the greatest respect and professionalism, you have to keep pushing forward. You have to do the analytics. You owe that to the client, which is the most senior leadership, if they have the responsibility to push the whole organization forward. And by the way, that's not only performance on the street, that's tens of thousands of livelihoods in some instances, right?
Yeah. So healthcare is a great one. Because, you know, there's the cost factor. There is if they're interfaced with some university, there is the patient experience, you know, all kinds of stuff. And so, like, how often do you go in there to a place, maybe a healthcare place, and the senior leadership knows there's a problem, but they don't want to start in the C-suite. They want you to go figure it out in the organization and do something out there and fix this problem, because they don't want to face either the dynamics of C-suite conversation and egos. And so they're hoping you can kind of do it out there somewhere. How often does that happen?
More often than you would think, right? Part of it is if this is done right and they ask us to come in, they're asking us really to be a trusted advisor. And if we're a trusted advisor, we have to be able to operate within the organization. And frankly, again, with respect, you have to break some glass, but you need the air cover in order to break glass in an organization. I've been known to break an awful lot of glass in organizations, but you could only do that with the backing of the leadership, right? But then you can have candid conversations. And look, I've been in department by department, so is my team. We've talked to leader after leader, but we've also talked to people, quote unquote, on the assembly line, whether it's in education or whether it's in a healthcare system or a major bank, or frankly, a major media company, which are very interesting animals in and of themselves.
I'll bet.
Really kind of interesting animals in and of themselves. So, you know.
So how often do you have to, like, you go into department by department, or you go do in your initial phases of, you know, the first few weeks or months? I don't know how long these things take. Probably depends on the size of the problem, the size of the company. But, and then you assemble all this stuff, and then you've got to go have that conversation with the C-suite. How often does that happen?
Almost every engagement.
Talk a little bit about that. So the C-suite either doesn't know or is pretending they don't know that the problem's in their lap. And so, or most of it, I'm not saying anything's won, but, and you've got to go have that, set me up. So I'm in a boardroom, or you're in a executive meeting where you've got a table of people and you've got 10 or 15 senior leaders, and here's Philip. And you got a slide deck, or maybe you're not doing that. You're just sitting with them. Talk me through that.
So let's use an example of a healthcare system, right? I'll put it to you in this way. How difficult do you think it is to manage an organization, which the vast majority of which is usually trending from -1.5% to -10% on revenue, which means they're losing money all the time? All right. So you have to manage that kind of dynamic while delivering care, while having a brand, while working with the government. 50 cents on every dollar that goes through every healthcare system in this country comes from the federal government. So, I mean, there's a real dichotomy of what's the right word, of masters that they have to play with, right? And have to go toward. So, when they ask us to go out and figure out what the problem is, we really have to do that. And that could be in their organization, in their systems, in their technology. We've seen healthcare systems spend an awful lot of money, buy a piece of technology, think you plug it into the wall, and by magic, it seems to work. It doesn't honestly work that way. So you have to go gather all of that data. But then you do have to come back to that boardroom, whether it's with the CEO or the COO or the chief financial officer or chief information officer, and you have to lay out the facts as you see it. And I'll tell you, very often there's an opinion before you lay out those facts. And sometimes, and this is the truth, I wish your listeners could see this, I've actually seen executives or leaders in education push back on their chair from their table and say, wow, we really didn't know our organization operates this way. Because we actually map it out and we show them, you know, in an image on what's really going on. And it's a very powerful statement. But after that, if they have the courage, they buy in and do the work that's needed and have the professionals there to do the work with them.
So, Tell me what's your favorite part of this work? And again, we're still in the corporate space, but what brings you, because, you know, I started with the question, what do you do to add good to the world? And your corporate answer was, I help people get out of their own way so their organizations can perform better. Get, you know, better is a subjective thing, whether it's healthcare, patient experience, or it's not really making money because you said they're losing money anyway. But maybe it's a media company, or maybe it's something else. Like, what is the really favorite part where two things happen? One, you really feel like you've mattered. And two, you have a sense of real fulfillment. So you come home and you go like, yeah, I did that. What happens?
Terrific question. So the first part, the thing that I get the most satisfaction of, right, is when our team, my team and I, have done the hard work, sometimes for months, sometimes longer than a year. We've been on the ground. We had one time we were on the ground at a client for 4 years. They kept asking us to come back and do more work, right? So yeah. when we're in the trenches with their team and we really identify what the benefit is to their organization, whether it's economic, whether it's a process change, whether it's culture, you know, or something else, right? I thoroughly enjoy and am rewarded by the surprise that brings to the organization, because more often than not, it simply isn't understood at the outset. They may think they have a problem. They may even think they understand what the problem is. But we are not a knight in shining armor. So I want to be very clear about that. We help the organization help itself, right?
Right.
Okay, that's a big, you know, no one rides in on a white horse here. But that too is part of it. We help the organization help itself, and then we go away. Yeah, we may have been there for a long time, you know, but we go away. And the first part of your question is, I am always astonished and pleased when I see someone in leadership who's thinking about bringing us into the house. They think they have a problem. They're not sure what it is. And we help them identify that. We help them give them some, not only strategy, but some financial direction. What is this kind of impact going to look like in 2, 5, and 10 years to your organization? And they say, we're not sure, but, you know, let's give this a chance. And then 4 months into it, they become the most rabid supporter of your effort, right? They're 180 degrees turned around because they can't believe that their organization is responding. They can't believe they found the money that's being saved. They can't believe the culture is getting that much of a positive shock and change. So those are two things that I'm thrilled about, if you will.
I love it. And you know what I love most of all, Philip? I love the energy and joy in your being and around your body and face as you talk about this. It's really evident and obvious. So I'm going to switch gears completely here. No, I don't know completely. How did you get here? So tell me, what is there in Philip's life experience that has brought you to this place where you're that guy and it is that much fun? How come you're doing this?
Well, without telling the whole life story, I think it's been a bell curve life. I was born and raised in Brooklyn. I didn't grow up like the average kid, I guess. I started selling comic books when I was 13 and ran some of the very first comic book conventions in New York in the early 1970s. So it's a while ago, okay? But that instilled a level of entrepreneurship in me, you know? And we moved forward and I had retail stores and then I went to school and graduate school, and I was in a PhD program, and thank God I never finished that. But I wasn't going down that path. I wasn't going to be an academic or clinician. But and then I actually got a request to do an assignment in the quote unquote corporate sector, and that corporate sector turned into an opportunity for a quote-unquote job, leadership job, which I had for a few years. And then a door opened up and I became the executive director for foreign government and diplomatic services at Western Union and then AT&T. And I had a life which I traveled around the world at 100 foreign governments that were clients. I helped them all with everything from information management to secure encryption technology way, way, way before you've ever heard of cybersecurity. Okay.
Right.
Way before that, you know? And I often, you know, tell people, you know, the Undersecretary General of the UN was at my 50th birthday party and our wedding when we got married a couple of years later. So, you know, it was really a sense of delivery that I enacted. And then what happened is ultimately that went on a path and I was a partner in one of the large global consulting firms. And then I said, I've had enough. I've been with organizations that have 200,000 or 300,000 people around the world, and you had assistants and marketing and the like. And I decided, no, let's try this on our own. And, you know, you go from 300,000 to 7 and you take your own garbage out, you know?
Right.
Okay. And it's a shock, but I knew we could set this up and have the same kind of impact. And that's really how, you know, we got there. And you know, when I started the firm, it's almost 13 years, you know, we came out with actually a very different locus and focal point in our service portfolio. But today it's what I mentioned to you, you know, we started out in a different way. So even ourselves, you know, we couldn't become a victim to our own success. We had to make the shift. And, you know, not only is it rewarding, I think it has the greatest impact.
I love it. So I want to ask you a question. You said, you know, hundreds of, I don't know, they're not that many hundreds, the countries, all the places you've been. I think there's what, almost 200 countries, 180 or 90, or maybe there's 200. I don't know. But anyway, what would you say that you learned that maybe you didn't expect, or maybe you did expect it, but from seeing across all these different cultures and societies and countries and laws and government structures, like what has struck you as interesting that you'd like to share with the group here?
I'll tell you a couple of points. This is not a political statement. Jimmy Carter happened to have been a hero of mine, right? And one of the reasons why he's a hero of mine is the only man or person to become president of the United States that claimed it was a stepping stone to do better good and greater good for the world. And he did it for 40 years after he left the White House. So, you know, great, great, great credit in that. But he also said something that I think stuck with me when I dealt with foreign governments, when I dealt in diplomatic circles. And he said that when you're entwined in those kind of dynamics, you know, logic doesn't necessarily rule the roost. So you have to suspend judgment. You have to put your judgment up on the shelf and deal with the circumstance and the people you are with in front of you. And I think that was an extraordinary lesson, because I will tell you, without naming countries or people, I had everything happen to me, from being offered bribes and gold Rolex watches if I made a government's bills go away. Okay. And that's coming from, you know, someone in diplomatic leadership for that country. Okay. You know, right. To, you know, having an office at the UN and dealing with members of the foreign press. There too is an interesting point. You know, not everyone in the press corps thinks the same way or reports the same dynamic in the same way. So you have to have, at least when you're in that kind of role, you have to learn to suspend judgment. And that, I think, has served me personally extraordinarily well. And it's funny, because I was just talking to my 15-year-old about this last night, oddly enough, that this comes up today, because he's taking global history, he's in the 10th grade, and he was going through the major wars and dynamics in the global stage and in the Cold War. And we got to a point where we were talking about the collapse of, you know, the Berlin Wall and the like. And he said, well, and he mentioned Tiananmen Square. And I said, you know, the Chinese government was a client of mine at that time. And you had to see his face kind of freeze.
I believe it. Right? Yeah.
How could you have done that? And I said, because I wasn't pointing the guns and the tanks at that person, nor was I supporting that dynamic. I was dealing with what needed to get done. Now, at the same time, I will finish this point. And I told him that, however, there were two governments that I found their repressiveness so morally repugnant that I just couldn't suspend the judgment and I would not work with them. I'll leave them nameless, you know.
Yeah.
One has changed dramatically, one has not, but I just couldn't get past the finish line on those two.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue. So I want to thank you for sharing the worldview and particularly that piece about judgment and tolerance and, you know, understanding points of view, all that stuff. And we'll set aside the bribes and everything for a minute. You know, we'll swap stories about that someday offline. But anyway, because I had some experiences, whatever. But so we'll swap that later. I want to move now to the personal side. So this experience with vastly different wealth distribution systems and privilege distribution systems and stuff that, you know, have been forever and maybe will be forever in the world. You said you were the head of a 501c3 that did some stuff. So talk to me about the personal side, because you painted a good picture of what you do corporately and the kind of wisdom and research and work that you bring there. And I want to understand the personal manifestation of this person now. Tell me about your work there.
The organization, I mentioned the name, it no longer exists. It was merged with another organization a number of years ago. But it was started by a rabbi here in New York. It was called Interns for Peace. And they raised funds because, to your earlier point, how do you have empathy? How do you work and suspend judgment? One of the things you need to do is have tolerance. And tolerance is really difficult, particularly on the international stage. So he built a tolerance training institute where people were deployed on the ground in really challenging places, sub-Saharan Africa, Southern Sudan, the West Bank. And you went out into the street and, you know, one of the techniques was to bring people from different backgrounds together and put them in a circle and have a set of strings and have them all from the center hold a string out. And then they realize no one is at the head. There's no beginning, there's no end. And it becomes something that you work, move, and support together. You know, no one pulled on the string harder than anybody else. And, you know, I brought my diplomatic and foreign government experience to that organization. And then I was asked to be, you know, the chairman of the board. And I took that rather seriously. As a matter of fact, I took a year off, quote unquote. I hope my wife's not listening. She wasn't happy about this, but I took a year off between the time I left the global consulting firm and the time I started my firm, because I needed to put this organization on the road to its next chapter. And we did that. And then unfortunately the founder passed away, but we had already merged and I went forward, you know, and they went forward.
So I want to dig into your heart. Mm-hmm. What made you decide that you're going to take a year off? Because the career trajectory and the impact you're having, global stage and this and that, someone can say, whoa, now you're taking a year off to do what? That could easily be somebody's thought. And what I really want to know, Philip, is in your heart, What made you believe that that was important enough to take a year off and make that happen?
So when I left the global consulting firm, it happened to have coincided with the financial crisis. And the market was clearly in flux and turmoil.
Are you talking about 2008?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so
that's right. That's right. And that kind of impact also affects 501(c)s. Ask anyone in nonprofit, the moment there's a chink in the armor in the financial markets, it has a downstream effect in not-for-profits. And, you know, I was at a point where I'm trying to figure out what comes next for me. And I was asked to do and step up and do a lot more for this organization. So I sat down at our dining room table. I had just gotten, engaged, and we were going to be married a few months later. And my wife was rather startled that I was devoting this amount of time to this organization. But, I had to have my own center. We are fiercely independent individuals. That's why we didn't get married until I was 50, I just had to step up and feel that I was giving back. I had already been at the UN. I had already been all around the world, right? I had already traveled personally. One of the defining joyous moments of my life was actually someone I met at UNICEF, who is a friend now for more than 30 years. We went trekking in Nepal. We came very close to trekking and hitting Everest Base Camp. And I can tell you, the month that we spent out in that part of the world and really, really understanding the dichotomy in economics and in health and the deployment of technology and the challenges of government, go to Kathmandu and then go try, climbing, and trekking in the Himalayas, and you'll get a flavor for what the world is. And yet these are some of the most peaceful and centered people that you can find on the planet. And that was very, very striking to me. That's why I had to move the organization forward until it was time for me to start the business.
So I'm having a sense of a depth of commitment about that sort of thing. And we live today in a tumultuous world all over the world. There are wars, there are conflicts, there are people dying, there are civil wars, there is suffering, there is starvation, there's a political instability in many nations. And I live in Canada and you live in the US, but my wife and I are dual national, so a lot of noise in the US about different things. What would you share from your experience and the things you learned on your trek through Nepal and seeing the stark contrast about being happy independent of stuff and wealth? And like, what would you share as wisdom for us listening who haven't had those experiences that might influence how we talk, how we act, how tolerant we are, what we say, and that sort of thing? What would you share with us?
I came into marriage and parenthood, quote unquote, later on in life than a lot of other people, right? Some people wait until their retirement before they travel around the world. Well, I flipped that around. I traveled around the world and worked around the world, before I, quote unquote, settled down, got married, and began a family. But I can tell you that we have, I believe, an obligation to the generation that comes behind us to ensure that they understand the true meaning of empathy, grace, dignity, balance. And I'll tell you how I do that. And it's very, It's very personal. It's very local for me. And ever since my son was very, very young, we love to walk around here in New York City. And, you know, New York City can be a challenging place. There can be homeless people sleeping on the street. There can be people begging. There can be, you know, violence, screaming, selfishness, ostentatious wealth, whatever you want to call it. But when he and I are together, and this doesn't mean it excludes my wife, but when certainly I have an opportunity to speak to him and we see this kind of circumstance, we see someone who is, you know, unfortunately a schizophrenic and they're babbling to themselves. I explained to my son, you know, son, we may not be able to do something for this individual, but we can never laugh at this individual. We must have great empathy in our heart for the challenge that that person is facing and for what it does when it presents, when it presents itself, you know, in public. And we have to have the intelligence, the grace, and the dignity to understand that, be empathetic. If there's something that we can do in a bigger sense or broader sense, fine, but then we walk past. But we never, ever cast aspersions on those who are less fortunate than we.
So there's several things in there that I really like. And I think that, how many kids do you have?
I have one 15-year-old son.
So you have one 15-year-old son. What do you think, and there might be a million of them, that might take 2 weeks for you to describe, but what do you think the main differences are that he has compared to his friends or others that he might, you know, in his age group, in terms of how you are? I mean, like, you did several things. One, you had lots of years of experience before you had kids, so your view on the world and parenting and stuff are going to be substantially different than somebody that had a kid when they were, you know, 25 or whatever. So what do you think the big differences are for him compared to his friends, and how does he navigate that?
That is a great question. I'll answer it in two ways. You know, he often laugh on how old his dad is, or when we go to the movies or take an Amtrak train, we ask for one senior, one adult, and one kid. It's kind of funny, you know, but he processes it that way, which is fine. But we have instilled goodness in this kid, and I think he does think twice when he encounters this. And not everyone has either a two-family house, you know, a two-parent household, or certain experience where they can bring the kind of knowledge and framework and perspective that I shared with you a couple of minutes ago that he has then compared to some of his, both his friends and fellow students. As a matter of fact, I'll just give you an example. He knows that there are some people in his class who cannot afford lunch out on a daily basis. They have to eat school lunch, you know, and the parents don't even send lunch, you know, to school for him. And on Fridays, he takes these kids, you know, for pizza in the afternoon. And I just ask him if he pays for it. And it's okay. And yes, I know it's our money, but there's a grace that is underpinning that, that I think my wife and I, my wife and I are very proud and glorified to see, you know, that's been instilled in him. I really do. And, you know, on the flip side, I think he also knows how lucky he's been, you know, but I'll tell you, I said I was going to answer that in two parts. I'll reference someone who's on morning TV, and she's very famous, and she kind of did the same thing we did. She had a child much later in life, and she made a statement that she does the math all the time. And I find that very compelling because so do I. And what I know she means by that is you look at your life and the point you are in your life and how old you are and where your family is. And you have to say, I have more runway behind than I do ahead. So you have to make every day ahead count. And that means do everything you can, you know, for the family, but also for that child, given whatever that runway is. And I hope, you know, my mom was 98 when she passed. So I hope I'm here for certainly a long more, you know, certainly a long road ahead. But I know when you slip, I know exactly what she meant about doing the math all the time.
Yeah. So I really, really love that. And thank you for letting me pry in a little bit personally, sure. Because I love to understand the heart of people, because this whole thing's about adding good to the world, sure. And your ultimate life, I mean, a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy. And you've demonstrated each of those in the different phases of your life and how you're passing it on to the next generation. So I want to give you an opportunity now to tell us, tell the listeners where they can find out more about you. If they'd like to see things that you've either written, books or videos, or maybe you're not active on social, I don't really know. So if someone wants to learn more about you and follow up with this conversation, maybe not with you personally, or maybe, but with more about you, where would they do that? How would that happen?
You're quite right. As a matter of fact, a lesson I've learned from you, if you're not posting at least twice a week, you're probably not out there enough. But and I don't, but that's changing right now. So the name of our firm is Above Par Advisors. And I'm not a golfer, so you can forget about Above Par, meaning anything to do with golf. But AbovePARAdvisors.com, and we're launching a new website. And we, in fact, are going to host and post things that I've written, that I've commented on, that I've recorded videos about, and get an opportunity to go a little deeper in my point of view and our point of view.
I would love, and I'm not in the habit of giving guests advice, but I'm going to, if I were to advise you to add even more good to the world, creating a record, writing things down, videos, books, some kind of thing that institutionalizes your approach in companies and personally, and encouraging people to get involved and do things instead of telling themselves a story that they're only one person and they can't do anything and all the rest of the crap that people do. I think it would make a huge difference and would be really valuable if you're willing to do that over time, just to build a legacy of stuff. Yeah. And I for one would really think that'd be a good idea. So that's just a thought for you.
Well, and thank you. And I know you've encouraged me to consider, putting it between two book covers, and that's probably a smart path. I just have to find the right time for it,
Yeah. Well, so we're going to run out of time here. We just got a couple of minutes left, Philip, and I want to give you the chance to say anything that we didn't talk about. I don't care if it's an example or advice or any kind of thing. Take a minute here and say anything that we didn't talk about that you want to share.
Yeah, thank you. I've been recording a lot of videos and making small posts about the challenges that organizations are facing, and largely that has a lot to do with the national uncertainty that I think we are all operating in. Again, not a political judgment whatsoever. It's a fact that there is constant churn and national uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to root ourselves that this too shall come to pass, however long that may take. The tragedy that we're seeing in war, the tragedy we're seeing in political violence, the tragedy, I think, that we're seeing in political rhetoric has a downstream effect. Look what it could do to a 13-year-old or a 15-year-old if they, who are on social media more than any of us, see this and it gets downloaded. Imagine what it means to them. So, and how confusing it is. So I think we have to root ourselves in a long view and know that this this experiment in democracy shall long endure, to quote Lincoln. And I think we have to be the shepherds of that. You know, even though things look very challenging, if you will, at the moment.
Philip, I want to thank you for sharing your heart, for sharing your learning, and sharing your encouragement to us, with us today.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. And you asked some phenomenal questions. So I hope I stepped
you
up.
You did perfect. Just absolutely fabulous. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
So I want to encourage you to think about this. This is a really seasoned guy with chops all over the place, with opinions about culture, about tolerance, about how to raise kids, about you know, how to get along, all kinds of stuff. And I respect him both for his professional work and his personal view and encouragement. So take the opportunity to go back and listen again and learn what there is to learn, and ask yourself those difficult questions about how you are showing up in the world. Because all of these questions, all of these things that we can learn from anybody will contribute to our journey to create your ultimate life.
You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.